From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Surprise, surprise in Iran. In one of Condoleezza Rice's Outposts of Tyranny, voters defied the predictions of pundits and pollsters in Friday's presidential poll. Or did they?
Allegations of vote rigging and fraud mar presidential elections in Iran. We'll speak with veteran Middle East journalist Dilip Hero and Iranian-American writer Roya Hakakian. Her family supported the revolution, then fled. Then, big oil and the White House.
Government scientists recently wrote a report on global warming. They said the Earth is undergoing a period of relatively rapid change. Then the report went to the rewrite shop at the White House. They changed the word is to maybe.
We'll look at how a Bush administration official downplayed climate change in key documents, then quit and is now returning to his roots to work for ExxonMobil. We'll speak with the award-winning New York Times reporter who broke the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, a suicide bomber killed at least 20 policemen, wounded more than 100 others when he blew up a car on a crowded sports field in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil. Witnesses say the bomber was dressed as a policeman and drove onto the field more than some 160 police were exercising. Meanwhile, coordinated morning attacks in Baghdad claimed the lives of five other Iraqi policemen. This came one day after a suicide bomber strapped with explosives killed nearly two dozen people at a busy Baghdad restaurant frequented by Iraqi police. The bombing topped a series of bloody attacks Sunday that killed at least 37 Iraqis nationwide, including 12 members of the U.S.-trained security forces. The restaurant was less than 400 yards from the main pedestrian entrance to the U.S.-protected Green Zone. More than 85 people have been killed in attacks over the past 48 hours. The Los Angeles Times reported over the weekend that up to 60% of the estimated 12,000 prisoners being held in Iraq face intimidation, beatings, or torture that leads to broken bones and sometimes death. The paper quotes officials from Iraq's Ministry of Human Rights, as well as international human rights groups and defense attorneys in Iraq. Saad Sultan, who's head of a board overseeing the treatment of prisoners at the Human Rights Ministry, told the paper, quote, there are beatings, punching, electric shocks to the body, including sensitive areas, hanging prisoners upside down and beating them and dragging them on the ground. He added, police and security forces attached to the Interior Ministry are responsible for most abuses. The Sunday Times of London is reporting the British Foreign Ministry's legal office ruled that the sharp increase in the U.S. and British no-fly zone bombings of Iraq in the year leading up to the official invasion was illegal under international law. The paper says the advice was first provided to senior ministers in March 2002. 2 months later, the U.S. and Britain began spikes of activity designed to degrade Iraq's defensive capabilities in an effort to goad Saddam Hussein into retaliating and giving the U.S. a pretext for war. The Foreign Office said the bombings were, quote, not consistent with U.N. law, despite U.S. claims that they were. In the so-called Downing Street memo, British Defense Secretary Jeff Hoon is quoted as saying in July 2002 that the U.S. had already begun the spikes in bombing. In Iran, electoral authorities today ordered a partial recount in the country's inconclusive presidential election after reformists accused military organizations of rigging the vote in favor of a hardline candidate. The recount comes just 4 days ahead of an expected second-round runoff between the top two candidates in Friday's poll. Former President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the mayor of Tehran. We'll have more on this in a moment. This news from Lebanon, an anti-Syrian alliance led by the son of assassinated former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, appears to have swept the final round of Lebanon's legislative elections, securing a majority in the new parliament. Saad Hariri's coalition appeared to have won at least 65 of the parliament's 128 seats. With a majority, Hariri's alliance would be expected to try to remove current Lebanese President Amir Lahoud. He's viewed as pro-Syrian. With al-Qaeda leaders continuing to issue defiant statements and many of the major figures identified by Washington still at large, the Bush administration appears now to be laying blame for this on international law. In an interview with Time magazine, CIA Director Porter Goss said he has a, quote, excellent idea where Osama bin Laden's hiding. In his first interview since becoming head of the CIA last year, Goss said, quote, dealing with sanctuaries and sovereign states, you're dealing with a problem of our sense of international obligation, fair play. Goss added, quote, we have to find a way to work in a conventional world in unconventional ways that are acceptable to the international community. Goss did not say where he believed bin Laden was hiding. Oil prices have hit a new record high, soaring to a whopping $59 a barrel. The price has risen $5 a barrel over the past week. Sudan has dropped charges against two aid workers accused of spreading false information in a report alleging widespread rape in the Darfur region. A spokesperson for Médecins Sans Frontières, known as Doctors Without Borders, said the Sudanese justice minister issued a notice on Sunday. One of the world's most wanted war crime suspects may be on the verge of being arrested or handing himself in. For weeks, there's been a buzz in the Serbian press that General Ratko Mladic's days of freedom were numbered. Now, the Times of London's reporting, he struck a deal for $5 million in so-called compensation for his family if he gives himself up to the Hague War Crimes Tribunal before the 10th anniversary next month of the Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia, which he's being held responsible for. Former President Bill Clinton has joined the growing chorus of voices attacking the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo. In an interview with the Financial Times, Clinton called for the camp to, quote, be closed down or cleaned up. Clinton told the paper, quote, if we get a reputation for abusing people, it puts our own soldiers much more at risk. And second, if you rough up somebody bad enough, they'll eventually tell you whatever you want to hear to get you to stop doing it. Meanwhile, Arizona Republican Senator John McCain spoke out on Guantanamo as well as on an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press, arguing that, quote, even Adolf Eichmann got a trial. McCain called on the Bush administration to create a system of fast and fair trials for those imprisoned there. He said the detainees, quote, deserve to have some adjudication of their cases, despite what McCain called a fear that if you release them, they'll go back and fight against the U.S. McCain said, quote, balance that against what it's doing to our reputation throughout the world and whether it's enhancing recruiting for people to join al-Qaeda and do bad things to the United States of America. Meanwhile, a speculation abounds over the future of Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist. Senator McCain was asked about who he would like to see replace Rehnquist. Host Tim Russert asked McCain about his comment during the Republican presidential primary in 1999 that if McCain was elected president, his role model for his first justice named to the Supreme Court would be Justice Antonin Scalia.
I think he would be, frankly, someone who would be approved by the Senate. I don't believe he would be filibustered. No, I don't. Now, there's many others that I also would strongly approve of as well.
Now, Justice Scalia, as you know, believes that Roe versus Wade, which made abortion legal in this country, was incorrectly decided. Do you agree with him?
Yeah, I certainly do to some degree because it was based on medical knowledge and technology at the time that indicated that babies children are not viable at as early a stage as they are today. So there certainly wasn't based on sound, up-to-date medical technology. We save babies every day that are premature at a very early stage. Thank God.
John McCain speaking Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press. White men coming out of prison get more than double the number of job offers that African-American ex-convicts receive and about the same number as African-American men with no previous prison record. This according to a new study by two Princeton professors that sent white, black, and Latino men posing as ex-convicts to apply for thousands of job interviews in New York City. The study found for every 10 black men without criminal convictions who receive a job offer or callback, only three with convictions got positive responses. This compares to 7 out of 10 white men. Nationwide, 1 in 3 black men with only a high school diploma will go to prison before turning 40. Nobel laureate and Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi turned 60 years old on Sunday. Protests were held around the world calling for her release from house arrest, which she's been under for almost 10 of the past 16 years. Author and historian James Weinstein has died after a long bout with brain cancer. He was the founder of In These Times magazine. Congressmember Bernie Sanders of Vermont, the independent member of Congress who is a Democratic Socialist, told the AP, quote, Jim Weinstein was one of the intellectual leaders of the American progressive movement. And one of the leading disability rights activists, Freda Zames, died last week at the age of 72. She was past president of Disabled in Action of New York. At her death, she was vice president of the organization. With her sister, Zames wrote the book, The Disability Rights Movement, From Charity to Confrontation. And yesterday was Juneteenth, the day marking news of the emancipation of slaves reaching Texas in 1865. While its roots are in Texas, Juneteenth Day has become a national commemoration.
In 1864, the burying began. Despite that rabble, Robert Lee, we took away. Just outside of Washington, his hills spread far and wide. Soon corn gave way to crosses as young soldiers died. And where will they go when there's no more room in Arlington? Arlington, the hills go on and on. Veterans and fresh fallen side by side. Bugles blow and caissons roll 24 times each day. At that rate in 15 years there'll be no place to lay in Arlington. In Arlington. Private William Chrisman was the first one we laid down. Now there are a quarter million in that hallowed ground. In Mrs. Lee's rose garden, we planted near 2,000. Those just the boys who fell down at Bull Run. And where will they go?
Arlington. The band Uncle Wade, the singer Andy Revkin. He'll be our last guest on today's broadcast, the New York Times reporter on global warming. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Voters in Iran headed to the polls Friday in the closest presidential election since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. But electoral officials today ordered a random recount of 100 ballot boxes following accusations of vote rigging and fraud by several of the candidates. In a surprise result, the hardline mayor of Tehran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, came in second behind former President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani. The two candidates will face each other in an unprecedented runoff election later this week. Ahmadinejad is a former Revolutionary Guard who's looking to reinforce Iran's strict Islamic code. He's spoken against restoring ties with the U.S. Rafsanjani, who was president of Iran from 89 to 97, is described as a conservative pragmatist and has called for a, quote, new chapter in U.S.-Iranian relations. Ahmadinejad came in only 1.5 percentage points behind Rafsanjani in Friday's election, despite being a virtual unknown ahead of the race. Allegations of vote fraud soon followed, with the circumstances around the election raising suspicion. When the Interior Ministry issued its first results, it had Rafsanjani in first place, followed by reform candidate Mehdi Karoubi. Half an hour later, the Guardian Council announced Ahmadinejad was actually in first place. The Guardian Council is made up of hardline clerics that have ultimate control over government actions, but it's not supposed to interfere in ballot counting. When the final tally was announced, Rafsanjani finished with 21% of the votes and Ahmadinejad with 19.5%. Critics pointed to other irregularities, including the Tehran mayor's announcement Saturday he would be in the runoff, hours before official results were issued. Meanwhile, Iran has called on President Bush to apologize for criticizing the elections as undemocratic ahead of Friday's vote. Some say the high turnout of 62% discredited Bush's comments. The intelligence minister said Bush, quote, motivated people to vote in retaliation. On Sunday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice also criticized the legitimacy of the electoral process, in which unelected clerics barred most of the 1,000 presidential hopefuls, including all the women, from running. We turn now to Iranian-American author and journalist Roya Hakakian. She was raised in Tehran before leaving Iran for the United States when she was 18. She's a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. Her memoir of growing up in post-revolutionary Iran is titled Journey from the Land of No. We're also joined by veteran Middle East journalist Dilip Hero. His latest book is called The Iranian Labyrinth, Journeys Through Theocratic Iran and Its Furies. We welcome you both.
Thank you.
Now, it's very good to have you with us. Well, I'd like to start with Roya Hakakian, your response to the elections.
I think the elections were, as far as I'm concerned, illegitimate to begin with, which is why Pretty much everyone in Iran and outside, a lot of the leaders boycotted the elections to begin with, including Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Peace Laureate. An election where, you know, the leading candidate is Hashemi Rafsanjani is compared to 1997 elections that brought in sort of the hope of reform, is profoundly disillusioning, and I think it was the right decision to boycott the elections to begin with.
Why is it disillusioning?
Because we witnessed since 1997 the hope of reform dying in Iran. We witnessed a lot of the newspapers that were inspiring hope among Iranians be shut down. We witnessed journalists be taken away and remain in prison, bloggers being hauled away and remain in prison. And we basically saw a crackdown on what we thought would bring in the era of reform. And in the aftermath of all of that, having this election, which was basically lackluster and lacked all the, you know, leading candidates that we had in 1997, was just, you know, two steps back.
Dilip Hero, do you share these thoughts?
I think I will start with, of course, we have to remember there's something called Islamic Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Let's just take a very quick example. Mr. Bush and Rice applauded in Saudi Arabia what I call one quarter election. It was for local councils. It was only for half of the seats were allowed to be contested. Women were completely barred from voting. That's one quarter. And of all the people, was remembering, who were entitled to vote, only one quarter bothered to vote. So that was one quarter election, and what did we get from the White House? Democracy is arriving on a camel back on Saudi Arabia. So what I'm saying is, let's compare like with like. You know, here is the Islamic Republic of Iran, here is the Islamic Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, let's look at Condi Rice talking about outpost of tyranny. Now, in outpost of tyranny, we don't know who's going to win. In outpost of tyranny, we don't know what the turnout will be. In outpost of tyranny, there are tens of Western correspondents and television companies covering the whole election. In outpost of tyranny, you have voting system almost like in the U.S. So that's the background. Is specific? Sure. Of course, all the pollsters were saying that this Rafsanjani won to be followed either by Mr. Mustafa Mohin, reformist, or by Mr. Qalibaf. Generally speaking, I know, of course, I've done a book on the subject. I've been to Iran dozens of times. You know, I'm very much aware of the whole thing. Khatami, of course, failed to take head on the mullahs. That's a fact. You know, he failed in that. At the same time, this particular election, including this hardliner, he described himself as a fundamentalist reformist. So you see, the the format, the language that was used in this election always was on the side of, why does it happen? Because in Iran, you know, the voting age in Iran is 15, and no politician can afford to ignore what the young people want. You know, and the second point, simply, it doesn't matter whether there was a rigging or whether there was too much money spent, et cetera, et cetera. As long as there's a system where every 4 years or 5 years, politicians have to go back to citizens and say, please vote for me. I'll do this and that. They may not do it, but that is, for me, a dynamic. And Iran, this was the 9th election of president. You know, last year, 7th parliamentary election. And they had 4 elections for assembly of experts. If you add all of them, there are 20 elections in 26 years. Now, you find me a country anywhere in the world where they had 20 elections. Now, they may be rigged. I don't care. But at least they are holding them on time.
We're going to go to break. Then we'll come back to our discussion on Iran. Our guests are Dilip Pirro. Among his books, well, the latest is The Iranian Labyrinth. We're also joined by Roya Hakakian, Iranian-American author and journalist. Her book is Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood Caught in Revolutionary Iran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back with them in a minute. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations, low-power FM stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org. Our closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And now our website, we have translated headlines into Spanish at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the elections that took place this weekend in Iran, condemned by the Bush administration. Our guests are the author of The Iranian Labyrinth, longtime Middle East expert Dilip Pirro, and Roya Hakakian, Iranian-American author and journalist. Her book is called Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood Caught in Revolutionary Iran. Let's talk about the lead-up to the elections. Roya, could you talk about both the bombings and the women's protest and where women stood?
The bombings, I personally don't have very much to say, except that the period of bombings that I remember the most occurring in Iran were in the early 80s to mid-80s when we were involved in the Iran-Iraq War. And then the Mujahideen, the People's Mujahideen of Iran, recognized that they're losing power to the fundamentalists and started to commit acts of suicide and that sort of thing. I think part of what became clear about the sources of the bombings is that there are ethnic tensions in southern Iran and possibly ethnicities that want to create a sense of independence or want to create their own separate republics or have a bigger voice within the ethnic mix are responsible for them. That's as much as I know. I don't know very much more. However, I think what's really, really uplifting and terrific to watch about Iran is the women's movement. The fact that women in Iran came together to stage exactly where they had staged the biggest protest early on, almost 6 weeks after the revolution. In fact, on March 8th of 1979, in front of the University of Tehran, and repeated that.
International Women's Day.
Exactly. In fact, Kate Millett and a lot of American feminists went to Iran in March of 1979 to join the Iranian feminist movement against the edict that Ayatollah Khomeini very early on, upon returning to Iran, announced, which was, let's bring the Islamic dress code back. And women staged a massive protest in 79. And this was very much reminiscent of that. And I think, in fact, part of what that reminded me of, and I think part of what really connects these two pieces of history, is that we're recognizing that much of what the 1979 revolution was all about has come back in 2005 in a way, in a bigger way than 79 could, you know, people in 79 who engaged in it ever dreamed of, which is women's rights and democratic rights and civil liberties.
Explain what happened to the women protesting this time.
It came as a result of, I suppose, weeks and months and months of organization. You're looking at a population of women who have become extremely outspoken through either through blogging, establishing internet communities, establishing small NGOs. It's basically women in Iran who run a great many women's shelters and newspapers and write for various newspapers, whether it's on the net or not. And the idea of, you know, as women, if you cannot participate in the elections, then, you know, how can you possibly consider the elections fair if a woman candidate cannot run? And there were women candidates who wanted to run. And it seemed like in light of the reform movement being dead, as far as, you know, the developments that many of the Iranian intellectuals consider, the best thing was to use the attention that was coming to the elections as an opportunity to stage women's demands to before the media and the general public, who were intensely watching watching Iran and the developments. And I think it was a brilliant idea.
Mm. De Lapiro, the significance of this and how the Iran elections fit into the whole picture of the Middle East right now. Condoleezza Rice today is in Egypt. This weekend was in Palestine and Israel. And, of course, what's going on with the resistance in Iraq right now.
Yes, I mean, I think, excuse me, let me give you a couple of simple facts. Between 1976 and 1996 in Iran, the female literacy rate went up three times. It was 28% in 76, and in 96 it was 80%, one. Secondly, I have been to Tehran University, and in humanities and so on, 90% of students are women. All over Iran, in universities, 60% of all students in Iran are women. Now, you tell me any Western country where they have 60% women students, I'll take you out to the best restaurant you choose in New York. Seriously. You see, I am very much aware that they cannot be judges, they cannot be president, but I'll tell you one other thing about women.
But see, you're leaving out the fact that the population of Iran has doubled.
I did not interfere when you were speaking. Please don't interfere. Wait for your turn. You know, it's not a question of, I'm giving you percentage. 80% of women in 1996, women were literate. I can give you the reason why, etc., but we don't have the time here. I'm just giving you basic facts. In 20 years, under the revolution, the female literacy rate tripled. Right. Then we come to the simple thing about what they can or cannot do. Of course, I'm very much aware you cannot be a judge. I know that. I mean, I'm not that I've fixed it. Okay, but assembly of experts is the most important thing. And unlike most people, they don't understand. If I stand up here and say, the way Iranians elect their supreme leader is the same as the way Americans elect their president. How do they do it? electoral college, indirect election. In Iran, they do the same thing. And that electoral college is called Assembly of Experts. All 83 members of Assembly of Experts are directly elected. So there are parallels between Iran and America. You'll be surprised to hear. There are parallels between Iran and America. There are different centers of power. Okay, now, Assembly of Experts, last time, 1998 election, is women said, why can't we contest? And why cannot? Because all of them are mullahs now. And a non-mullah say, why can't we contest? You know what happened? Guardians Council says, yes, you can contest. Take this test on theology. There were 89 people allowed to take a test. Of course, all flunked. But the point is, the principle is accepted. Women can now contest for Assembly of Experts, which is the most powerful body. I'm just giving you some facts, because we all have this image, women wearing this chador, that is Iran. I have myself been to Persepolis. I have seen women employees who are guides, who sell books. They are wearing makeup. You know, and they have very skimpy, you know, jackets up just below their knees. I have been to the Shah's, old palaces, where women employees wear makeup and so on and so forth. I'm sorry, these are basic facts I'm just telling you. On paper, things are awful. In reality, you want to see men and women holding hands when they are not married, go to any park in Tehran after sunset. Okay, I'm just, satellite dishes, one out of two houses in North Tehran have satellite dishes. A police guy comes there and he says, oh, okay, then they say, I will confiscate this, and they pay them some money and they go away. Okay, so I mean, just giving you facts. Now, in terms of what happens next, certainly, you know, I see the parallel. You remember what happened in French elections when the socialist candidate did not get number two and Mr. Le Pen was in the second run. What happened? All the socialists and all the left-wing people, they said, vote for Chirac. And that's how Chirac got 82%. I think that's what's going to happen now. The reformists already have decided to support Rafsanjani, not because he is the ideal guy. Of course, Rafsanjani got so much baggage. I can add to what she said earlier, that during Rafsanjani's watch in 8 years, 87 intellectuals and journalists were assassinated in those 8 years. These are facts. Okay. So I'm not saying that Rafsanjani is a great guy, but now the reformists have a choice. Either very hardline Mr. Ahmadinejad or Rafsanjani. I think they're going to support him on the same principle that the socialists and left-wingers supported Chirac when he was against Le Pen. You know, and that's basically what's going to happen. And therefore, I think they will encourage reformists to go and vote. So next thing to see in this next election on Friday, what is the turnout? Is it going to be more than 60% or less than 60%?
Raya Hakaka, in your response.
Statistics are meaningless unless there's a context. And the context for these statistics is that the Iranian population in 76 was only 35 million, and it's now nearing 70 million. So when you have a population that has basically doubled since 1976, you're going to have more of everyone, you know, having registered, including women and all other minorities in all sorts of fields. So I'm not sure the statistics themselves, without the proper historical and population context, will make sense. The second thing that I think is very important to bear in mind is that the fact that there are satellite televisions in Iran, the fact that women are being very subversive and do, in fact, as Dilip mentions, wear, you know, their Islamic dress code in extremely subversive ways, isn't a credit to the regime or doesn't reflect in any way, as far as I'm concerned, the democratic values of the ruling elite. In fact, what it really proves is that a population, and by the population I'm referring to the Iranian women, that were extremely oppressed over the first 10 years of the revolution, found a way to speak up and have turned into the regime's biggest opposition power. I think I want to credit that to the power of women and to the growth and consistent emphasis on women's rights and the way in which Iranian women really regain their voice, as opposed to really chalking it up to anyone else's credit. The last issue that we're talking about here, and I think is really worth mentioning, is that the only strike against Rafsanjani, although it's a significant one, isn't the loss or the assassination of the intellectuals, which is a very, very significant issue. It's also the fact that you're talking about a man who is the eighth richest man on Forbes' list of the richest men in the world. You're talking about someone who in 1978 was basically, you know, your average cleric. And we know that that Rafsanjani, since, you know, the past 27, 28 years, doesn't really have any patent or discoveries to his credit. So 27, 28 years of being, you know, in the service of the Iranian public couldn't have made him that rich. So you're talking about...
What did?
I mean, that's actually the subject of many, many interesting, you know, investigations. He has really basically turned, the Rafsanjani family have turned into the biggest mafia going within Iran. Part of the reason that the reform movement couldn't make the headways that, let's say, the Chinese have made since Tiananmen. Because, you know, if you look at the China model, you see that the Chinese made economic reform, and as a result, the issue of civil liberties really died away in China. The fact that Iran cannot make economic reform is the reason why the issue of civil liberties cannot be pushed to the side the way it was pushed to the side in China. And the reason is because the Rafsanjani family is extremely corrupt. It is a mafia that runs Iran economically. And basically nothing can get done in Iran without the involvement of Rafsanjani family and without other people, you know, whoever wants to invest paying some degree of money to this family. So to, you know, imagine that after 8 years of hope for reform, you are basically putting in power the man who not only runs the biggest mafia going in the country, but was also responsible for the assassination and the killings of Iranian intellectuals, then, you know, the picture is extremely grim.
In the context, De Lapiro, of the Middle East, the trip of Condoleezza Rice, she's now in Egypt, Iraq, what's happening there, Israel, Palestine.
Yeah, I think let's take Egypt. And, of course, I heard the press secretary saying Egypt has first elections in 7,000 years. I didn't know this guy was an Egyptologist. The point is that Egypt had multi-party elections from 1922 to 1952 when there was a military coup, for example. And now Mr. Mubarak has put conditions for individual to run. I can assure you, I mean, you can actually push through a camel through a needle's eye, then you, as an Egyptian citizen, can get the 350 signatures of legislators at the local level, provincial level, and the national level. You know, and that, Laura Bush suddenly became an expert on Democracy Now. Maybe you should give her a membership, you know, Democracy Now. She should be an associate of this. What does she know about it? You know, as for Palestinians, people forget that the first election of Palestine took place in 1996, and the turnout was 75%. Arafat got 87%. This time the turnout was less than 50%, and if you take over overall, Mr. Abbas got only 40%. So is it that Mr. Bush and Condi Rice invented democracy for Palestinians? They've been out long before. As for Lebanon is concerned, Cedar Revolution, that has been the republic since 1927. They had elections all along except during, you know, the civil war, 15 years. You know, and that, again, is a very religious division. Quick example. Half seats for Christians, half for Muslims, you know. And amongst half of them, the Shiites have half of the Muslim seats and the Sunnis have. But Shiites are twice more numerous than Sunnis, but they have the same number of seats as Sunnis have. Now, you tell me, that is the kind of basic democracy which Mr. Bush should be taught to say, elections in Lebanon violate the basics of democracy because for two Shiites, you are giving, you know, one Sunni vote. You know, I mean, this, so much of this. Basically, what I have always said, it isn't that Iran is a democracy. What I keep saying is, very simply, Iran has what I call a representative government. I don't say they have multi-party system. You have multiple choice. Even in the case of Mr. Ali Khamenei, after the death of Khomeini, assembly of experts met up. He only got 6-0 votes are 83. One. Secondly, which not even many Iranians know, that is a major flaw of my book of information. Would you believe Assembly of Experts actually has a subcommittee which monitors the performance of the Supreme Leader? In theory, they can throw him out. He is not Supreme Leader for life. He is only for 8 years, which is the tenure of Assembly of Experts. So some of these basic things have to be understood. Constantly you hear unelected leader. No, he's not unelected. Including the CIA website has got it wrong. I hope somebody pick up the phone and tell them to get it right. Khomeini was for life, but Ali Khamenei is not for life.
Last comment, Raya Hakaki, and you seem to be shaking your head on that last comment.
You know, again, one can look at what's on officially on paper. You know, officially on paper, someone mentioned to me at a different radio interview that Iranian constitution was taken line by line from the Swiss, except that the Iranian women, having to testify in a court of law, their testimonies count as half that as men. So, you know, tell that to the Swiss or the Iranian women and tell them that, you know, they have equal rights, and we obviously know that they don't. The reality about the Supreme Leader is that you have a guy that basically has the power for 8 years, 16 years, or, you know, 1600 years, who has the power to basically overrule any election and the constitution itself. So the period in which that he gets elected is really irrelevant. What's really important is that he becomes so almighty that every other institution and law gets to be subverted.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Certainly an issue we will continue to cover. The runoffs are taking place, the election next Friday. Roya Hakakian, Iranian-American author and journalist. Her book is called Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood Caught in Revolutionary Iran. Dilip Hero, veteran journalist on the Middle East. His trilogy of books on Iraq and Iran, considered some of the most definitive in the history of wars in the Persian Gulf. His latest book is called The Iranian Labyrinth. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at global warming. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration worked behind the scenes to weaken key language in the Group of Eight proposal for joint action on climate change. The Washington Post reported Friday that administration officials successfully pressed negotiators to drop sections of the report that warned of more frequent droughts and floods and committed a specific dollar amount to promoting carbon sequestration in developing countries. This follows major revelations published in the New York Times earlier this month that a White House official repeatedly edited government climate reports in ways that play down links between greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. The official, Philip Cooney, was chief of staff for the White House Council on Environmental Quality, which shapes much of America's environmental policy. Before coming to the White House in 2001, Cooney was a lobbyist at the American Petroleum Institute. Just days after that article was published, he resigned from the council, and ExxonMobil announced they were hiring him. A recent investigation by Mother Jones magazine found ExxonMobil has spent at least $8 million funding a network of groups to challenge the existence of global warming. ExxonMobil defended its hiring of Cooney by stating they hire from both sides of the aisle. In a written statement to Democracy Now!, the company wrote, quote, ExxonMobil hired Mr. Cooney at about the same time we hired Matt Gobisch, who was the communications director for Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman. We've also hired highly qualified people for their talent, not their politics, ExxonMobil wrote. We're joined now by Andrew Refkin, the New York Times reporter who broke the story about Philip Cooney. Andrew Refkin's prize-winning science writer at the New York Times, and he wrote the book Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and Burning Season, The Murder of Chico Mendez and the Fight for the Amazon Rainforest, recipient of the National Academy's Communication Award for Print Journalism, two Science Journalism Awards of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, as well as an Investigative Reporters and Editors Award. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. So let's start off with the Philip Cooney saga. Tell us how significant it is that he ran the White House Council on Environmental Quality, where he came from and where he's going.
Well, Phil Cooney, who I've only met once, he's kind of in the background character, at least in terms of the White House public persona. He went there in 2001, and before that, for about a decade, he was a lawyer for the American Petroleum Institute, which is the leading lobby for the oil industry in Washington. And his last job there was, they called him climate team leader, and he was in charge, essentially, of an effort to both forestall any kind of international agreement limiting greenhouse gas emissions blamed for global warming, and also domestic legislation. So it was and regulations. The EPA was considering regulating CO2 coming from car exhausts, carbon dioxide being the main greenhouse gas, and he led the effort from the industry to stop all of that stuff. And then he went to the White House in 2001, and essentially, at least according to everything I've seen, continued that same effort.
Talk about what he deleted, what he took out of the reports.
It's all, if you looked at individual wording changes and revisions and rewrites, you might say, oh, you know, what is that? It's just a little qualifying adjective, or, you know, what's a big paragraph in a 300-page document. But when you look at the sum total of what changed, essentially scientists from a dozen agencies and other officials from a dozen agencies spent months on these reports coming up with language that they thought framed the issues correctly as far as the science goes. So when they put in a line that said the Earth is experiencing environmental change right now, that they meant that. It's a real thing. It's a pretty unassailable fact. And in that instance, he changed the word is to maybe. The Earth may be undergoing a period of unusual environmental change. And that kind of thing, for scientists, again, is just sort of anathema. The idea that someone who had no scientific training, he's got an economics bachelor's degree and a law degree, and also with essentially a vested interest for years in not accepting the science on global warming, that he was doing that kind of revision, it was kind of horrifying to scientists within the government. And that's why they came to me with the documents.
Hmm. Yesterday, John McCain, who's basically announcing that he's running for president, was on Tim Russert's Meet the Press. And Russert questioned him about your report on Philip Cooney.
Senator, let me show you a story from Wednesday's New York Times. Philip A. Cooney, the former White House staff member who repeatedly revised government scientific reports on global warming, will go to work for ExxonMobil this fall. Mr. Cooney resigned as chief of staff for President Bush's Environmental Policy Council 2 days after documents obtained by the New York Times revealed that he had edited the reports in ways that cast doubt on the link between the emission of greenhouse gases and rising temperatures. What do you think of that?
I'm shocked, that such a thing should be happening. I also noticed that he immediately went back to work with ExxonMobil. Maybe he should have waited a month or two.
John McCain on Meet the Press yesterday. You just interviewed John McCain. Your response and also overall to what he is putting forward.
Well, McCain and a few other Republicans of various degrees of moderacy have been trying to put distance between themselves and the White House. I think they see public opinion on this moving in a direction different from where the White House has put their policy so far. And so he has, despite embracing the administration on many fronts, he seems to have, he doesn't want to be identified with them on this one. And he has this proposal that's part of could be part of the energy bill that would require cuts in greenhouse gases. It's a very gentle proposal. It's nothing like the Kyoto Protocol, which was much more the slope of that was much more steep. And this would be really kind of a slow slide toward regulation. And
also putting forward nuclear within that.
Well, right, and then he in order to broaden the base of support for the bill, he chose to add nuclear power, which actually has weakened his proposal now because a lot of the mainstream environmental groups just can't go there. Even though nuclear power, for all its warts and problems, doesn't emit carbon dioxide like coal-fired power plants or gas or oil do when they're burned. So it's clean to the extent that it doesn't contribute to the climate problem. And so but he's got this funny dance that he has to kind of to make to find a common ground there, and I don't know whether it's possible, frankly.
On the issue of questioning global warming, on another of the talk shows yesterday, this week with George Stephanopoulos, George Will weighed in.
They are almost as united today and almost as certain today that global warming is a threat as 30 years ago they were that global cooling is a threat. We've got some excerpts from journalism back in those days. 30 years ago, George, the New York Times was warning about the return to another ice age, that major cooling of the climate is widely considered inevitable. Science magazine warned of extensive northern hemisphere glaciation, glaciers in northern Europe that were going to be. Christian Science Monitor said again, glaciers have begun to advance. And my favorite from International Wildlife, a new ice age must now stand alongside nuclear war as a likely source of wholesale death and misery. Now,
conservative columnist George Will on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Andrew Refkin, your response.
Well, the 30 years ago, we were in a period of cool times. From the 1940s to the 1970s, what had been a pretty long, prolonged warming trend stopped for a while. And the growing scientific consensus on why that happened was because of another kind of pollution. In the big post-World War II industrial boom, we were putting up sooty stuff into the atmosphere that blocks sunlight and makes the Earth cooler. And the modeling and observations now seem to confirm that essentially we were the cooling input from human activities was overwhelming the warming input. And now, of course, since the 90s, there's a warming trend that no one says is somehow a natural, at least it's not dominant, that the natural influence isn't dominant. It's almost conclusive that it's a human-caused warming now. And as far as the Ice Age consensus back in the 70s, some of that was driven, keep in mind that in the 70s, we didn't even know that, we hadn't confirmed yet the continental drift was happening. Science has progressed a huge amount since the 60s and 70s, and the modeling, the computer power that's been used to analyze what's happening with the atmosphere is just orders of magnitude beyond where it was then. And the scale, the time scale, you know, the return to an ice age would be centuries, millennia, and the warming that is predicted to be very disruptive to ecosystems and human affairs is something we're talking about within the next 100 years.
Speaking of cold, you have gone to the Arctic several times. Can you talk about what you found there?
Yeah, I've been. I'm going again this year too. I've been to the North Pole, to the North Slope of Alaska, and to Greenland over the last couple of years. And in all of those places, scientists have seen pretty powerful evidence of as that climate report that the White House changed said, of significant environmental change right now. It's still a complicated picture. The Arctic is a place we don't have a lot of long-term history or data on. So you can't immediately say that the trends that we've seen in the retreat of sea ice in the last three decades from satellites is unparalleled. The 30s saw some warming in the Arctic. It wasn't as uniform as what's going on now. And in the past, of course, I wrote a story last fall. You know, 50 million years ago, there were ferns growing on the Arctic Ocean. It was 60 degree body of water. You could swim in it. And now it's got ice on it. So there's on all scales, there's warming and cooling. But the pace of change in the last few decades is what has people really alarmed. On the North Slope, it's actually woken up the oil companies there for the first time. The oil industry, when I reported a story a year or so ago from the North Slope, the frozen season when they can explore for oil has shrunk by half in just 30 years. It used to be 200 days a year that the Arctic slope, tundra, was hard enough to drive a truck over, and now it's 100 days. And so they pushed Alaska to start a new study to look at the rules and what's going on up there. So it might be that the Arctic warming is the first instance where we've seen a lot of concern from the oil companies about the implications of warming.
And yet you have them pouring money in, like ExxonMobil, to discount global warming, to raise questions about whether it's even a problem.
Some would call that a paradox.
Before we end, I wanted to talk about your book, The Burning Season, The Murder of Chico Mendez and the Fight for the Amazon Rainforest. You actually wrote it 15 years ago, but it's just been reissued in paperback. Can you talk about who Chico Mendez was and how he relates to this whole story of global warming?
Well, there are two things. The Amazon itself only became a big news story because in the late 80s, it was linked in our consciousness to global warming. The forests were burning. Our satellites showed thousands of fires in the Amazon at the same time. And Chico came out of the forest around that same time in 1987. He was kind of the ultimate pragmatic grassroots organizer. He tried communism once, and that didn't work. He tried politics, and he was a terrible politician. He was a homegrown rubber tree tapper from the Amazon who saw the forest falling because roads were being built, bringing ranching and other activities into the Amazon. And he didn't just sort of lie down in front of the bulldozers. He came to Washington and followed the money, which is a... He essentially wrote the book for how to get results. Even if you have a small local issue like that, you find, where's the money coming from? What is the force that's actually changing my life here? And for the rubber tappers, it was money partially flowing from the Inter-American Development Bank, the big international lending institutions. And he went to senators, and Senator Kasten from Wisconsin, and said, look, you know, why are you helping support this activity? They're not paying attention to the people living in the forest. And he got progress. Brazil created the first extractive reserves, and areas where you could harvest from the forest without knocking it down. And then, of course, he paid the ultimate price because some ranchers commissioned his murder. And it's become relevant again in a few ways. Partially, the Amazon is burning again at the rates it was back then in the late 80s, and that contributes hugely to the climate issue, the climate problem.
What do you mean burning?
The forest, the rate of destruction of the forest there is greater than ever. And when you to clear the Amazon, you burn it. You cut and burn. That's basically how you clear. The burning season happens every fall. It's sort of the end of the dry season. And anytime you burn a fuel or wood, you're adding carbon dioxide to the air. And carbon dioxide lasts 100 years once it's up there.
And the significance of the rainforest in Brazil for the globe?
Well, it's a reservoir of carbon, the stuff that when we liberate it by burning it adds to the climate issue. And, of course, it's also a reservoir of biological richness that's relatively unparalleled. There's only a few places on Earth with the amount of species of plants and animals that the Amazon has. And it's kind of a giant sponge. It's 20% of the Earth's fresh water at any one time is in the Amazon. It's an amazing, unique resource for everyone.
This past year, the American nun Dorothy Stang was killed. Can you connect her back to Chico Mendez?
Yeah, Sister Dorothy was one of many American nuns who've worked down there the last 30 or 40 years. I got to know some others who worked directly with Chico. They were all fighting the same fight, which was basically for people who had been pushed off of other land by the rich Brazil and found no place to go and were eking out a living. In some cases, like Chico, it was rubber tapping. In other cases, like the area in Pará, where she was working, it was farmers. But they were all facing the same thing. The farmers in the Xingu area of the Amazon were trying to find a way to do forestry and farming together so they wouldn't ruin the forest. And then large-scale timber extraction and ranching efforts are pushing in. And she got in their way just like Chico got in their way in 1988.
Chico Mendez bringing together the labor movement and the environmental movement. Do you think that's finally what did
him? Well, efficacy is what did him in. And the efficacy came in part by linking things. He was sort of into globalization. He invented kind of a reverse form of globalization where you, before the internet or anything, he uplinked his little homegrown movement to international environmental groups. He meshed labor and environmental issues and got some results.
And deeply believed in nonviolence.
Absolutely.
Well, Andrew Refkin, I want to thank you for being with us, author of The Burning Season, The Murder of Chico Mendez, and The Fight for the Amazon Rainforest, also New York Times science reporter. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Bokadoosh, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Neil Geiser, and Maddie Harper. Our website is democracynow.org. You can sign up there for our daily headlines and go to the website for transcripts to see and hear the broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.